you will excuse me, I'm going to speak pretty close to the podium mic here and let the lapel mic go so that we don't have the interference, the noise. Usually people don't leave the auditorium screaming until after I start preaching, but apparently this evening word had gotten out that I was supposed to be the speaker, and so some were trying to get a jump on the rush to the outside. However, if you are driving a maroon Hyundai with Limestone County license plates, your car is parked out front with its lights on. You may leave and turn your lights off, but you have to come back, okay? You have to come back. And we know that not everybody's driving a maroon Hyundai. Well, good evening. I appreciate your presence here this evening. This evening, I want to talk about a black sheep in the family of David. Seems like every family, sooner or later, ends up with one family member, maybe more than one in some cases, that's just a little bit strange. It's old Uncle Hubie, who's kept every bottle cap that he's ever pulled off of a bottle. And, oh, by the way, he also irons his money. And you have to be nice to him. And because he's family, and you invite him to the family reunions and send birthday cards and everything, but you really would prefer that others didn't know that he was one of the branches on the family tree. Some of you may remember a few years ago when President Jimmy Carter was in the Oval Office, he had a brother whose name was Billy. And I felt sorry for Jimmy Carter because you never knew what Billy was going to do next. And he seemed to be somewhat of a constant source of embarrassment to the president and his family because the media obviously shined the limelight on this black sheep of the family. Like I say, most families have got some black sheep. Somebody who's gone to prison or in some other way strayed from the path of respectability. And in a way, I believe King David had that same problem. There was a man in David's family who from time to time either angered David or shamed him. And that man's name was Joab. Joab was not just the commander of David's army through most of the time that David was king and reigned. Even prior to that time. But Joab was also David's nephew. Joab was the son of David's sister, Zeruiah. And he became David's commander, the commander of David's army. I want to talk a little bit about Joab's character this evening. And I would suggest to you, first of all, that I'm not so sure that the information that is recorded about Joab is given to us specifically for the purpose of character studies of Joab. Joab obviously figures into the house of David, the dynasty of David, and the Bible talks about that dynasty because it's relevant to the promises that were made to Abraham, and then of course there were promises even made to David himself. But at the same time, there are some interesting things about Joab's life from which I believe we can draw some rather practical lessons for our own lifestyles. Joab was not entirely a bad person. Don't want to say that. I think there were some good qualities to Joab, and that's how we'll do. We'll start, like Paul often did in the New Testament, by rehearsing some of the good things about people before we talk about critical things. And I'm just going to point out three things that I think shined a real good light on Joab in his life. You may recall in the Old Testament in 2 Samuel, and that's where we'll spend a good portion of our time in the books of Samuel and Kings. In 2 Samuel, the 12th chapter, the 11th chapter, records the adultery of David with Bathsheba. Of course, the husband of Bathsheba, Uriah, is off in battle. The battle that is being fought is against the Ammonites. And Joab is the leader of the Israelite army. As that battle is being fought, as the capital city of Rabbah, R-A-B-B-A-H, is being besieged. And, of course, we'll talk a little bit more about the story of David and Bathsheba and how Joab figures into that. But when that city was about to be captured, Joab sent messages to David urging him to come and to take the Ammonite capital city himself, for the express purpose that the honor of the capture would go to David rather than the commander of the army, who in this case was Joab. And so there's a sort of selflessness in Joab's action, or perhaps maybe even loyalty to King David in his action. This story is in 2 Samuel, the 12th chapter. The verses in particular are verses 26 through 28. On another occasion, on the occasion, of the death of David's son Absalom, a son who had killed the firstborn son Amnon, and who had rebelled against David, when Absalom was killed, Joab sternly rebuked David for moping around after Absalom's death. You might wish to turn to 2 Samuel, the 9th chapter. 19th chapter. And let's note some things about this particular story. At the end of chapter 18, David has received the news that his son Absalom has been killed. Absalom, of course, had been leading an army in the field against his own father, against David, wanting to take the throne from David. And when David hears that Absalom has been killed, chapter 18 of 2 Samuel, verse 33, records the emotion of David when he goes up to the chamber over the city gate and he weeps. And as he went, he said, "O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. O Absalom, my son, my son." And David's deep emotion and overwhelming sorrow at the death of his son really turns this whole occasion that was won for victory of David's forces, and victory for that matter of right, into one of sorrow and embarrassment. In chapter 19, Joab was told, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, "The king is grieved for his son." And the people stole back into the city that day as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. Here's David's forces who have routed the enemy and they've brought victory out of what looked kind of desperate, and they're creeping back into the city as though they had run away from the battle because the king is moping around over the death of his son, his rebellious son, Absalom. But the king, verse 4, covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice, "O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son." Now, I believe that what Joab did here, in the next few verses, was exactly what needed to be done. David was acting foolish here. He was acting as though the one who had rebelled and done wrong was the one that should be mourned, when in fact, those who had supported the king, and by implications, had been faithful to God also, should have been rewarded and congratulated. There should have been a celebration here. David is turning it into an occasion of mourning. So Joab came into the house of the king and said, "Today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the life of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well." And Joab says, if you don't go out and talk to the people, it's all over for your kingship, all over for your reign. And he was exactly right. Joab rebuked David when David needed rebuking and encouraged him to stand up and support what really was right. And I think that says a good bit for Joab. Now, one other story, just very quickly, kind of an allusion to this. Near the end of David's reign, as recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 24, David decided that he wanted to count the people. He wanted to take a census of the people. It becomes apparent as we study through the story, and 2 Samuel chapter 24 tells that story, as does 1 Chronicles chapter 21, that God was not pleased with what David did. Significant for our study is that Joab likewise did not support this. Apparently, the census may have had something to do with the business of determining what size army he had, because Joab is the one who was put in charge of that census. Joab didn't want to do it. And in fact, he did kind of a halfway job on it. He didn't finish the job. Joab obeyed the king, but he disagreed with David's action. And in this particular situation, he was right and David was wrong. Now, just one final note about Joab. Joab was clearly a skilled army commander and a good warrior. But he had some serious character flaws, and we may learn more from his flaws than we do from some of the good things that we've talked about so far. Let me suggest to you, first of all, that I believe that Joab was what we would probably call an opportunist, meaning that Joab was generally looking out for what was best for Joab. And frankly, the Bible doesn't talk about Christians as being opportunists in that sense. The Bible talks about us needing to look out after the interest of others first, rather than our own interest. But Joab looks out for Joab. And I want to give you at least a couple of examples of that. First of all, when Absalom killed his brother Amnon, and that was not a right thing to do, Absalom flees the land of Israel, and he goes into exile. But Joab encourages the return, the bringing home of Absalom. And I've often wondered why he did that. Something that may bear on that story, and this story is told in 2 Samuel, the 14th chapter, if you want to make a note. We're not going to take the time, obviously, this evening to read the story, the text. But you would find it interesting that Joab goes through some real efforts to get David to invite Absalom or to agree to bring Absalom back home. But what's interesting about this is that Amnon, killed by Absalom previously, and the reason for Absalom's exile, Amnon was the oldest son. And typically what happened was the throne would pass from father to the oldest son. But the oldest son is now gone. And the next son in line is the son who's in exile. It's Absalom. And one has to wonder if Joab was not trying to maintain some favor with the son of David, who might likely be the next king if in the future he did return. And of course, that's exactly what happened. Absalom was very likely at that time the oldest surviving son of King David. I kind of wonder if the reason for Absalom's action in this regard was he was simply looking out for Joab's future. After the rebellion of Absalom, there was a man by the name of Amasa who was offered the position that Joab held, commander of David's army. David had already negotiated with this individual. Joab, according to 2 Samuel, the 20th chapter, by craftiness, by deceit, assassinated Amasa. Again, against the will or the intention of David. But again, Joab is looking out for what's best for Joab, not necessarily doing what is right. Joab, to his credit, was faithful to King David when Absalom rebelled against his father. But in David's old age, after Solomon has already been designated God's chosen successor for David on the throne, another son of David by the name of Adonijah rebelled against David. This is recorded in 1 Kings, the first chapter. Joab, on this occasion, went with the rebellion and joined the rebellion of Adonijah, the oldest living son of David at that time. And again, I think it was just a matter of being a pragmatist. Joab believed that Adonijah perhaps had the greater possibility of taking power, and Joab wanted to be on the right side. Let me tell you something about opportunists. Typically, they are not concerned with doing what's right. They're concerned with doing what is best for them as they see that, whether it's right or wrong, morally speaking. Opportunists believe in that old adage that sometimes people repeat, and that is that the end justifies the means. And so rather than decide what's right and do what's right, opportunists look at the circumstances and they try to decide what's best for them. And sometimes they conclude that the best thing for them is to do something that God has forbidden, something that is wrong. Joab was that kind of person. And we see it several times, perhaps, in his life. Let me tell you something else about Joab. As you think about Old Testament people, obviously we don't have pictures, so it's hard to draw a mental picture of what Joab looked like. But what I'm trying to do is give you a picture of what kind of person he was. He was not just an opportunist. Joab was a vindictive man. He was the kind of person that you don't want to get on the wrong side of. You ever known somebody like that? Don't dare cross these people. Because they'll find a way at some point in the future to punish you for some sort of wrong, supposed wrong in some cases, that you have committed against them. Joab was that kind of person. For instance, in the early chapters of 2 Samuel, we learn that Joab's brother, Asahel, was killed by a man by the name of Abner. At the time, the kingdom of Israel, Saul's already dead, the first king, and the kingdom has actually divided. David is only ruling over the southern tribe of Judah, and he's ruling from Hebron. In the northern tribes, one of the sons of Saul is ruling, and there was warfare between Saul's household and David's household. Abner was the commander for the house of Saul. Joab is the commander of David's army or forces. And in a battle, in a war, a fracas between the forces, Asahel is killed by Abner. Now, Asahel is the brother of Joab. What the law provided for in terms of vengeance or punishment for murder was that if, say, for instance, somebody was to take my life, my younger brother, Andrew, if we were in living under the Mosaic law, my younger brother, Andrew, or a near relative, but Andrew would be one of them, he could be the avenger of blood. And he was authorized by the law to take the life of the person who had killed me. But you got to understand, that was a civil justice system. Asahel has been killed in battle. We're talking about a different circumstance here. And yet, Joab, by deceit, assassinated Abner. There's something interesting about this story. If you're in 2 Samuel, the third chapter, I'd like to read some of this so that you can get a feel for what's going on in the story here. Abner has gotten on the outs with the king in the north, and so he comes to David and basically offers to reunite the kingdom under David's rule. And David's agreeable to that. Joab, however, comes in a little late in the story, not realizing what had been happening, and he finds out the agreement that David has made with Abner. And so at that point, here's where we come in verse 23 of 2 Samuel chapter 3. 2 Samuel chapter 3, and let's start in verse 22. At that moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away and he had gone in peace. Abner's left already. When Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, "Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he sent him away and he has gone in peace." And Joab came to the king and said, "What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away and he is already gone? Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in and to know all that you are doing." When Joab had gone from David's presence, he, that is Joab, sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. Now when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately, and there stabbed him in the stomach so that he died, listen, for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Afterward, when David heard it, he said, "My kingdom and I are guiltless before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, and let there never fail to be in the house of Joab one who has a discharge or is a leper, who leans on a staff or falls by the sword, or who lacks bread." So Joab And Abishai, that would have been another brother of Joab, his brother killed Abner because he had killed their brother, Asahel, at Gibeon in the battle. Now, David mourns the death of Abner. I got to be honest with you. We're not talking about David's character here or mistakes he made. He should have, if you please, fired Joab, in my opinion, at this point. But whether he did or not, what Joab did was deceitful. It was wrong. It was vindictive. He wanted revenge for the death of his brother Asahel when that wasn't his privilege in the circumstances. There was a man that I knew as a youth who used to say pretty frequently in a humorous way, he said, "I don't get mad, I get even." You ever heard that? Ever said that? That doesn't sound very good coming from a Christian, does it? In the light that the Apostle Paul wrote, that we're not to avenge ourselves or get even, and certainly not to return evil for evil. Turn, if you will, to the book of Romans in the New Testament, to the 12th chapter of that book. Romans, the 12th chapter, and we're going to be looking beginning at verse 17. Romans chapter 12 and verse 17. I think everybody has at one time or another known someone who felt the need, or perhaps we ourselves have felt the need to avenge some wrong. And there are people who just, that's their lifestyle. They, every time they feel like they've been wrong, they're going to make it right by their vindictiveness, by their seeking to get even with the person who has wronged them. Listen to what the Apostle Paul says in Romans 12 and verse 17. He says, "Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men." Now listen, Paul says, don't return evil for evil. Someone has wronged me, perhaps. I certainly don't have the right to, in return, do something that is likewise wrong, that is evil. But Paul goes beyond that. He says, if it is possible, this is verse 18, "as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." And I don't believe it's any accident that in the very next chapter, Paul describes government as God's minister for vengeance. God has a plan for vengeance, but it's not us taking our own vengeance. Joab was a vindictive man who took his own vengeance as he had opportunity. Well, I want to talk a little bit now in the Old Testament, in 2 Samuel, the 11th chapter, about a story that most of us, perhaps all of us, are quite familiar. It is the story of David's adultery with Bathsheba. While there's no evidence that Bathsheba withstood David's advances, normally David receives the lion's share of the blame for the sins that were committed in that incident. And there were several, even beyond the sin of adultery or sexual immorality. But there was another party to the death of Uriah, and it was Joab, the commander of the army. Some of you probably are real remember very vividly the story of Uriah being called back from the battle once David has learned that Uriah's wife Bathsheba is with child. And David wants Uriah to eventually think that the child is his, so he calls him back from battle on the pretense of receiving some news about how things are going in the battle against Ammon. But Uriah refuses to go home and to be with his wife. He's loyal to the king, loyal to the rest of his companions back in the field. And so David then sends a message by the hand of the man that the message is concerned with to Joab, telling Joab that Uriah is to be sacrificed in battle. Deliberately sacrificed in battle. I want you to, if you will, go to 2 Samuel, the 11th chapter. And we're going to note a couple of verses here. Verse 16. If you were Joab, how would you have liked to be in his position? You've got a letter from the king saying that what you need to do is you need to set up one of the best soldiers in Israel and take him down. What would you do under those circumstances? Now, I am fairly certain that Joab probably did not know why Uriah set up. But did he really have to know? He's commander of the army. The king sends him a letter saying, here's verse 16. So it was while Joab besieged the city that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew there were valiant men. That's what David had told Joab to do. You send him out into a situation where he's going to die in battle. There's no doubt about it. We're going to sacrifice him. Then the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite died also. Well, of course, that was the plan. Then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war, and charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling the matters of the war to the king, if it happens that the king's wrath rises and he says to you, why did you approach so near to the city when you fought? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Was it not a woman who cast a piece of a millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? That was kind of a proverbial piece of wisdom. You got to not get too close to the wall so that he died in Thebes. Why did you go near the wall? Then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. And so the messenger goes, and he came to David, told him all that Joab had sent. And then the messenger said to David, surely the men prevailed against us and came out to us in the field. And then we drove them back as far as the entrance of the gate. The archers shot from the wall at your servants, and some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Then David said to the messenger, thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it. So encourage him. David's hypocrisy here is breathtaking. C'est la vie. Some people die in battle. When David knew that he had arranged this man's death, but we're not talking necessarily just about David. We're talking about the man who put the plan into effect. What should Joab have done on this occasion? What would have been the right thing to do? He should have refused. Joab defied David on other occasions. Remember the death of Absalom? The command was, don't anybody kill Absalom. If you can take him alive. And Joab ignored that order. And that may have been a valid thing to do. I'll not debate that question. But all I'm saying is that when it suited Joab, Joab didn't do what David said. Now David has commanded that a man be murdered in battle, make it look like it was just normal battle losses, and Joab goes along with it. There's an expression for that in the Bible. It's called being a partaker of other men's sins. And on this occasion, Joab fits that description. I'll tell you what was happening here. Joab was being tested. He was tested for his courage, tested for his sense of honor, tested for his sense of loyalty to his men as the commander of that army, and tested as to his sense of right. And he failed. In all of those respects, he got a failing grade because he participated in the murder of Uriah. Could Joab claim innocence since he was carrying out the orders of the king? What do you think? Should we obey men or obey God? The Apostle Peter answered that, didn't he? In the New Testament, in the book of Acts. Joab's first responsibility was to God, the one who had put David on the throne, not to the king. And what Joab did here was participate in David's sin. I want you to turn, if you will, quickly to the New Testament, and we'll be finishing up here rapidly with our lesson this evening. I want you to turn to 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter. On more than one occasion, the Apostle Paul wrote about this very thing. In 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter, and in verse 22, writing to the young evangelist Timothy, here's what he said. He said, do not lay hands on anyone hastily, nor share in other people's sins. Keep yourself pure. Turn, if you will, now to the book of Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 5. And we could begin reading, I guess, in verse 3, where Paul talks about there are certain sins that ought not to even be named among Christians. It's just not fitting for those who are holy ones, who are saints. Verse 3. Look down at verse 5. He says, "For this you know, that no fornicator, unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them." Don't share in their sins, because you don't want to share in the punishment that will come for those sins. I really believe this is the same point that the Apostle Paul is making over in 2 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, when he asks several rhetorical questions about what agreement there is between light and darkness and between Christ and Belial. What communion is there between unrighteousness and righteousness? He's saying that they're juxtaposed, they're against, in opposition to each other. And yet, the Christian who participates in ungodliness with unbelievers is always unequally yoked with those believers. I will tell you that following Jesus Christ, making decisions according to what is right, not what's convenient, or what may not always seem the best for our physical circumstances, will have consequences. There'll be a cost to being a disciple. But when I obeyed the gospel, I assumed that responsibility. I assumed that cost. I committed myself to paying that price. And if you're a Christian this evening, you did also. Joab may have been a skillful commander. He was a violent man, a vindictive man, who died a pitiful death. When the throne passed from David to Solomon, one of the things that David, one of the counsels that David gave to Solomon was that Solomon was not to allow Joab to die a natural death. Joab was already an old man. And in all fairness, David is unloading on Solomon what David should have taken care of, in my opinion. But nevertheless, Solomon carried out the wishes of his father. And when Joab rebelled along, or went with the rebellion along with Adonijah, in a sense he sealed his own doom. Later on, Joab would be killed in the sanctuary with his hand on the horns of the altar, seeking protection, seeking mercy. And yet his life was taken from him. His life really illustrates a principle that our Lord stated in the Garden of Gethsemane. Do you recall what Jesus said to the disciples when one of the disciples, evidently Peter, took a sword and took a swipe at the accusers, the arresters of Jesus? Jesus said, "For all who take the sword will perish by the sword." Or in other words, we reap what we sow. Joab lived by violence, and Joab died a violent death. There are so many lessons, practical lessons, that we maybe could take from the life of Joab, and I've suggested a few this evening, but I want to focus on that last one. And that is that basically we reap what we sow. The Apostle Paul talked about that very same principle in Galatians, the 6th chapter, in verses 7 through 9. And we'll close with this passage. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7, here's what Paul wrote. He said, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap." The first part of that sentence is interesting because it suggests that sometimes men think that they can sow one thing and harvest something else, reap something else. And what Paul says is you can't do that. You can't mock God. The law is you reap what you sow. Don't be deceived about that. "He who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life." That principle is illustrated in the life of Joab. And that principle extends beyond this world, beyond this life. Question this evening is, what are you sowing? Are you sowing to the flesh, or are you sowing to the Spirit? Are you sowing in such a fashion that you will reap eternal life, God's gift? Or are you sowing to yourself a harvest that is no more than destruction separation from God eternally, from the presence of God's majesty, from His glory. One of the problems that Joab had, I think, was authority. And that's why I suggested to Brent, when he asked about songs for this evening, I could have said, sing every song in the book about Joab. And I would have been up here earlier, because there's just not too much about Joab. Instead, I suggested, and Brent did a real good job of choosing some songs, I said, sing some songs about authority. Because Joab had a problem with that. He defied David's authority on several occasions, did what he knew David didn't want. And in so doing, he also defied God. And that's never a wise course. You know, when an individual's living according to their own will, they're living in sin, they are in essence in rebellion to God. That's hostility with God. Friendship with the world is enmity with God, James says in James 4:4. We can't stay in that condition. For those who are not Christians, there needs to be this surrender to Jesus, as we talked about earlier. Submission to the authority of God. God says that this is what an individual needs to do in order to be part of His spiritual family. And we can't rebel against that, or we'll end up reaping what we sow. Many of us tonight here are Christians already, though. We've made a decision. We've made a commitment. The question is if we're following through on that commitment. It may be that we've started to sow the wrong kind of crop. And what we need to do is come back to the Lord and make things right. Whether it's a public thing, others need to know of our repentance, or whether it's something that you need to enter into your closet and you need to speak to God privately about, I hope and pray that as we stand in just a moment to encourage you, that you'll take care of that matter with God as soon as possible. Get right with God. We encourage you as we stand and sing.